Welcome to another episode of the Sick Career Podcast. Today, I'm really excited to have from Orlando, Florida, originally from Colombia, and he'll tell us a little bit about that story, Daniel Botero. I met Daniel like I meet pretty much every one of my guests on this podcast through LinkedIn. I'm not an investor in LinkedIn, although I think I own Microsoft in my S&P 500 fund. But LinkedIn has been such a boon for building networks and meeting awesome people like Daniel. So I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation with Daniel. I'm going to read his profile of how he effectively summarizes on LinkedIn, and then I'm going to hand it off to him. But Daniel does a really damn good job on his profile. He says, I help STEM students land their dream job with any GPA and without applying to hundreds of companies. Message him to follow up for more info, and we'll talk later about how to get in touch with Daniel. But Daniel, love to hear a little bit about you and your words. Share with the Sick Career Podcast audience a little bit about you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for first of all, Alan, for having me on this on your platform, and super excited to be here. So just really quick about me, and this is really not about me. It's about trying to bring value to all of you. But I am an immigrant from Colombia, moved to the United States. So my mom went from never working a day in her life to working 7 days a week. And we moved here with $2,000. And that really kind of led to my motivation and my drive saying, hey, how do I make sure that the sacrifice that my mom made was completely worth it? And so that's in the drive to pursue the American dream, I went to college and then I graduated with multiple job offers. And I say that not because of being cocky or anything. I say that because I thought that anybody that went to school in America automatically graduated with tons of offers. And it wasn't until I realized that most of my friends were struggling to get jobs. My wife now, girlfriend at the time, who went to a better school, better GPA, on resume, better than me, right, was struggling to find a really good job. I was like, wow, if she's having a hard time, many people are having a hard time. And how I was able to do it. And it came down to the fact that I think I just felt like I was really good at one thing, and that was building relationships. And so that kind of is where everything started over 12 years ago of me saying, okay, how do I close the gap between what companies are looking for, what students need, and helping people? And I started doing that while I was still at PepsiCo. I was there for 6 years. And then about 5 years ago, I left there to focus on my full-time job of helping others land their dream job. And I built a company called Opni. And in that time, we've been able to build a really amazing career coaching company that specializes on helping international STEM students land jobs, because it's challenging to get a job, especially in 2023. It's even more challenging for international students. And so that's what we focus on. That's our clients. And we work with the clients until they get a job. And if they don't get a job, they don't pay for our services. That's how it works.
Nice. That's a great deal. And we'll go into that in a few minutes. But talk a little bit about the challenges that immigrants have in terms of getting roles in the U.S. and how you advise and recommend the clients that you work with, people on H-1Bs and so forth, of navigating those obstacles.
So I want everybody listening, whether you're an international student or not, to understand that every company, regardless of its size, and Alan, like obviously your history and where you've worked is incredible, right? Like the Salesforce, Facebooks, like all the top companies. And even the biggest companies to the smaller companies, all companies have limited resources. And so when they're making a hiring decision, they're making an investment. And when they're looking to hire an international student, that investment is a little bit higher, both because when you look at an investment, you look at two things, the risk versus the reward, right? And so not only can they do the job, but what's the risk of them being here for at least 2 years so we break even? And so when you add the complexity of being here an international student in an F1 visa, which if you're not an international student, that F1 visa OPT doesn't mean anything to you. But if you are, you know what I'm talking about. You don't have unlimited amount of time to get a job. You only have like 60 to 90 days to get a job. And once you graduate with a degree in America, depending on your major, you might only have 1 to 3 years to work here, an authorization. So for a company, that becomes really risky to hire someone that even if we love them and they're a superstar, they might not be able to stay here with us long term. And what happens most of the time when companies are hiring students right out of college is they're hiring students more for their potential than they are for their experience. And they're hiring these students because they want to build them into leaders. That's whether it's software engineer, data analytics, customer service, sales, you're trying to build these individuals to be the future leaders of the organization. And when these individuals who are very talented only have a limited time, it makes it a lot riskier to hire those individuals. So they face those challenges. And that is why less than 40% of all companies actually are willing to go through the sponsorship process of extending their work permit from 1 year to 3 years to being here for longer than that. And that's the H-1B process. And that becomes a lottery. So we can even talk more about that if you would like.
Yeah, do talk a little bit about the H-1B and the OPT and the visa statuses, because I have hired international people. I've hired people at Facebook and Google and Salesforce, all with visa. I would call it challenges, because when we were hiring people, I needed to work with different organizations within the company on the immigration side. And frankly, even at those companies which do hire lots of global talent, we messed it up. I almost had to retract an offer for an amazing candidate that we're recruiting over from Amazon to Facebook, and we almost botched it because of the visa situation, even though she was totally up and honest with us along the way. But share a little bit about the different visas and the differences between them.
One of the biggest actually exports that America has, and you probably don't ever realize, is higher education. So hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of students from around the world, primarily from China and India, are like the top two big countries that bring in students, come and get educated in America. So they come here in a student visa. It's called an F1 visa. And no matter what your major is, the United States government says, hey, you came here, you studied in America, you get 1 year of OPT, which is essentially stands for like on-the-job training for the major that you studied. You get 1 year so that you can kind of practice. Think about it as like a paid internship after you graduate, right? To get experience. And that's any major, whether you studied liberal arts or you studied software engineering. But then to go a little further, and because there is a lack of tech talent in the United States, right, there's a shortage in some of the more technical skills, the government says, if you studied a STEM major, we're going to allow you to stay 2 more years if you have a job. So if you have a job and you're getting paid, you're going to be able to renew that job training and stay here for 2 more years. Now, that's not luck. That's, if you went to school here, you get that regardless, right? And whether it's 1 year or 3 years, that depends on your major. So then the question is, well, Daniel, how do they stay here longer? And the most common path, and there's 4 paths to residency and citizenship, and that is 1, through family, like your parents ask for you, you get married or so on. 2 is because you're an investor, like a business investor, right? You invest millions of dollars and you create jobs. So there's tons of rules, all right? 3 is what they call Albert Einstein visa, like you're either an athlete or a genius, or like a really, 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 really top of your industry, like a best-selling author kind of type of thing. Or 4 is through a work visa. And the most common work visa for college students is the H-1B visa. And what that essentially is the government says, hey, we don't want to take jobs from Americans, but there is a shortage of tech talent in the United States. And because there isn't enough qualified tech talent to fill the jobs that are open, let's use some of those, you know, global talent, like you said, Alan, and keep them in the United States because these are high paying jobs and there's a demand because all these tech companies are growing, right? And so the government says, but let's limit that because I don't want to have unlimited amount of it. Let's limit that to 60,000 and let's add another 20,000 of cap if it's a very, very high skill, like if you have a master's or a PhD. So that ultimately creates a cap of 80,000 people. And then, companies have to apply for the individual. So a student cannot apply for that lottery. A company has to say, you know, Alan, I like you enough to invest and want to sponsor you. So I am willing to put your name in the lottery on our behalf. And you know, what's interesting, Alan, is that if you're so good, 10 companies can do that. You don't even have to be an employee of them. Let's say that you're really in demand. Every company wants to hire you and they all say, Alan, we're all going to put you. So Salesforce, Google, Meta, Tesla, Amazon, all put you there. And it's a random process. So not the most qualified person gets it. So it's random. If your name is selected for Amazon, then you're going to have to go work for Amazon. It's kind of like you're kind of obligated to then go work there. Every year, there's a different amount of people that apply for this. But every time we are seeing 300 to 400 people are applying for only 80,000 spots. So you have less than a 25% chance of getting it if you're only here for 1 year. But the odds are, because you're here for 3 years, because you study STEM, your odds dramatically increase to more like 60, 70, 80% chance of being selected. So that's kind of how the process works. It's like most of the time, in an ideal world, a student gets a job with a company that's willing to sponsor them, and they get three tries in this lottery. And if they don't get selected, they either have to go A, go back to school and redo this process all over again, or B, go back to their country, or C, get a visa from one of the other three ways I told you: family, investment, or they're a genius, right?
Yeah, interesting. So one thing that I've advised people about, I'd be curious about your perspective. I work with lots of international clients as well, and I advise people to look at a multinational company and apply to the U.S. if you want to be in the U.S., but there are considerations and hurdles to getting sponsored for a visa there. But if you're maybe from India, also look to work at Google in India. You can look in the States, you can look in India, and there could be an easier path in for you in India. It's not like there's reasons why people want to work in the States versus India or vice versa. But what's your thoughts on that strategy of applying like simultaneously to the States on the visa path, but also in your home country where you're authorized to work?
Let's talk about that a little bit, because I think that's good advice. And so I want to dive a little deeper on why that is and what you can do to increase your chances. So A, neither the company nor you have any say on the lottery. It's completely lottery. Again, it's not merit-based. So understand that Google has the same amount of chances as my small company with 20 employees does, right? So just so you know that. And so if all three tries you go through a lottery and you don't get it, there are options for you. And so I want to walk through those options. One option is exactly what you said: transfer to Google in India, and that works well. And actually, I would even say if you're not looking to go back home and you're like, hey, I want to stay in the West, a really good alternative that people don't know, it's actually Canada. Because Canada has immigration laws that are merit-based. And it's like a point system. And I'm not like an expert in the Canadian world, but I know enough that if you have a master's or a PhD in a STEM field, you automatically qualify for permanent residency where you don't have to go through those hoops. And there's companies out there, and I think one of them, I'm not affiliated with them, I get no money for doing this, but I think it's called Path to Canada, that will actually work with Google to relocate your job to Canada, because Google already has offices in Canada. And so what it will do is they'll relocate the job with Canada, and you're still reporting to the same manager, working with the same team. All of that kind of changes. The only thing that changes is that you're getting paid in Canada and you're paying taxes in Canada. And so it allows you to stay in the West. And if you become a resident in Canada, there's a path to citizenship. If you become a citizen in Canada, then it becomes easier for you to become a citizen in the United States. So there's this like workaround that you could do. Another alternative, again, don't want to go back home. Or another scenario that I see very often, Alan, is like a lot of Indian students were using this because that's a really common country. They have student loans in dollars. And if they go back home, they're not going to earn the same that they're earning in North America. And they cannot afford paying those back. So they have to stay here. If not, they're in debt for life, right? So another path to do this is there are universities that you can do another degree at night or weekends. And so like, let's say I got a master's in software engineer, I can go get a master's in data analytics or something that's relevant to my job that will actually help me in the future. And I can work 40 hours a week as a student, and I can continue to do that. So this is the scenario that I'll paint with you. 3 years, went to the lottery, did not get it. I still want to work at Google. I love my manager. I love my team. Google likes me. They want to keep me. So I enroll myself in these universities that are like night and weekends type of thing to a one-year master's or a two-year master's. It doesn't matter. And I'm still working 40 hours a week, going to school and taking like one or two classes a semester. I'm here in an F1 visa, but as a student, I can work under my CPT. So I still have a work permit. I can still work on their CPT, and I continue to be a student, but every year I go through the lottery over and over again. So I've seen scenarios where they go through the lottery, didn't get it the first 3 years, are a student for about 3 years. So 6 tries in the lottery and they finally get it. And then once they get the H-1B, they can drop out of school or finish the degree. And that's another scenario.
So for someone applying to a company, when they ask, do you need authorization, work authorization? If you're a large company, someone like Google or Facebook or American Express or whoever? Can they sponsor as many people as they want and put as many balls in that lottery as they want? Or does it cost them money? Why wouldn't they put everybody in the lottery and then they would get someone to work 1 year definitely? And if it's a STEM-based opportunity for 3 years. So like what's the downside of a company putting almost an infinite number of lottery tickets in this lottery?
Let's break this down. The cost itself, it's like right now is $15 to put you in the lottery. So that's nothing. You don't need to get that approved by no one, right? So in terms of
We were able to give out like $200 spot bonuses without any
right. So like support, so you're putting it up. So the cost of sponsoring someone is around $10,000 to $15,000, but it's not associated with putting you in the lottery. That cost is more associated if you're selected, and that's where the cost comes in. So to your point, Google can submit as many people and it doesn't matter because they're only bearing the cost if they get selected. And if they get selected, it's worth it because they're going to stay here long term. So the problem is this: you can't just sponsor any job. So let's walk through the process. You put in the lottery, you get selected. What happens next? There is this form, and I forget the name of the form, but it generally is done by a lawyer, and either company like Google might have internal lawyers that do this, or if you're a smaller company, you hire an immigration lawyer. And the form that they have to fill is essentially proving why there is a lack of people in America, residents or citizens, that can do this job. So if you're looking for a job for like a level entry customer service role or a sales job or some sort of like Apple and in the retail store, there's so many people that can do that job that if you file the form, and it costs money for the lawyer. That's where the biggest fee is the lawyer fee. And then there's the filing fee, which is a couple thousand dollars. It's going to get rejected. And that's where you see that the more technical the role is, the easier it is to like be accepted. Virtually 99.9% of all applications in software engineer, data analytics are accepted. It's where you get into the non-technical role. So anytime that you don't have a STEM major, you can pretty much guarantee that the company is not willing to sponsor because they know it's not going to get accepted. So it's not worth the lawyer fee or the filing fee. But when it becomes to a technical role, and the more technical you get, the more likely the company is going to be willing to sponsor. And yes, they'll put everyone through the lottery at that point.
So if you're someone that needs sponsorship, when you're applying to a company, like when you click off that box that I need work authorization, that will work to your disadvantage at times, I guess, because the company has to think about, will they invest the resources? Do they think it's likely that they will not only get you through the lottery, but to go through the legal case afterwards? So like by clicking that box, does that put you at a disadvantage versus an American citizen that does not need to click that box?
It's not that it puts you in a disadvantage. You're not going to get it. So the way like it works is, let's say you're working at a company and you're the manager. Before the job posted is even posted, the company has already determined if they are willing or not willing to sponsor for that role. So if it's not a technical role, they're not willing to sponsor. And the smart thing to do is to put in the bottom of the job description, we're not willing to sponsor. Because it just wouldn't be approved, or the investment is not there. And so that's where if you're an international student, my advice to you is like, there's tons of free tools out there, like Chrome extensions that actually will tell you, has this company sponsored for this role in the past or not? And not waste your time on companies that are not willing to sponsor. So all that information is public information. Actually, one of the best ways for me to know how much a software engineer at Google makes is actually going through like websites like myvisajobs.com and typing software engineers, because Google has to publicly let the government know how much they're paying. That way we know that you're not paying immigrants less. And it's not to protect the immigrants or the global workers. It's actually to protect the American worker, to make sure that you're not hiring global workers because they're cheaper. So anytime someone's ever won the visa and gotten an H-1B, their salary and job title is all public. And so there's people who've created, you know, aggregated that data and have been able to create tools to let you know if this company sponsors or not. And so I hope that helps, because it's not that the company is being evil. They either are willing and able to sponsor or they're not. And if they're not able to, there's a question, is like, will you now or in the future require sponsorship? And you click, right, yes, I require it. And the company cannot sponsor for the role then don't be surprised if you get an automatic rejection, but it's because they don't want to waste your time and they don't want to waste their time.
If there is some percentage of roles, when you click that box that you need sponsorship in the future, that will eliminate you because of your status. Then, like the advice I've been offering people, like let's take India, is apply for the role in Mountain View, in the case of Google, and apply for the role in Hyderabad in India and see which one you get. Ideally, you get the one in the States, but your application might get rejected there. And then if you work in Hyderabad, if you do well in your job there, there are opportunities for you to grow and develop within Google or within the company, and then they will relocate you internally. So do you suggest that people just look in the States or also simultaneously look in the market that they're authorized in as well?
I would actually say focus on the States first until you have no more options, because like you're going to get a job in India, right? Like your qualifications of getting a degree in American university is going to just make you stand out. There's billions of people in India and they do a really good job and have really good engineering schools as well. But that's going to just help you stand out when you're applying to an American company with an American degree back at home. So my advice is apply for all the jobs that sponsor, because again, those are all public information. You know which ones do, and focus here first. And if you don't, if you run out of time and you have to move back home or move to Canada or move to Australia, that's another like kind of like Western country that also is really friendly to global workers, right? Then you can do that as a plan B. But if your goal is to stay in America, just focus your energy and time that you, because you do have limited time. Every other job seeker who's not an international student, you have a lot of time. Like you have unlimited time as long as your finances correct. But you don't have legally a time clock that's ticking like you do as an international student.
So what happens when that time clock expires? I have lots of friends and sometimes clients that got laid off. And when they get laid off, then they need to get a job within 60 days. Or like if you graduate, you need to get a job within 60 days or depending on the time frame. What happens when that 60 days is up? What actually happens to you physically? Do you need to get on a plane that day on day 60 and go back home? Or what happens?
In theory, they can have an agent knock on your door and like deport you back. Most of the time, you have a good standing with the government because you have a visa. You don't want to ruin that. So you would go home before that date. Right? Or another option could be you just enrolled into another university and you renew your F1 visa.
So you can enroll in any university?
Pretty much any, as long as they're accredited. Like, you know, like you can't just enroll in Opni Academy and then call it a day. Right. Like, it needs to be like an accredited university. It's not any, but it's pretty broad. You can join a community college where you can be accepted in 2 weeks, right? Yeah. Like, if that makes sense. So
can you try to look for that job in the States for 60 days and then come 60 days, when that time period is up, you can no longer apply for jobs in the US, but you can then start applying for university. Like what happens on day 61 if you don't have that job? Because like I work with clients and on average, it takes us 3.56 months to get a job. And if I ever were working with that sort of pressure that within 60 days, I need to get a job, I'm just curious what happens on day 61. Can I even look for a job in the States, or I need to get on a plane?
You wouldn't be able to start working. You can convince a company to then put you into the lottery, but the lottery is in March. Legally speaking, you either get on a plane or you change your visa status to like an F1. Now, there are some loopholes and there are some tricks and trades of doing this. So like this is kind of like what we do with our students. First, we have to have very clear understanding when their clock starts and when it ends. So once you get to choose when the clock starts, you have 60 days from your graduation. So let's say that they're in summer and they graduate August 15th and me and you are working and you're my client, Alan. I would say, hey, because we're not really getting that much traction right now and the market is really tough, let's actually move your start date. So like your clock, your 90-day clock starts in October 15th. So if you do that, you just gave yourself 60 days plus 90 days, right? You now have 150 days to get a job. Now, let's say 2 months go by, right? And your clock is about to start and we're getting no traction, right? Like, you know, I'm talking right now, worst case scenario with you, Alan, right? What can you do? If the clock starts today, I will actually say, Alan, let's stop looking for a full-time job right now and let's get an internship. I don't care if you go back to an old professor and do free research. I don't care if you go to the nonprofit next to your house and work for free. What you need to stop the clock is an offer letter from like a company, whether it's a nonprofit, school.
Can it be from Kadima Careers?
Yes, you could give them an internship. I've given clients internships, but I don't want to go and mess anything up with immigration. So I say, hey, for 20 hours a week, you have to work on a project that's related to your major. Right. Because if immigration comes to me, I can be like, yep, this is the project Alan was working on. He's a data scientist and he's helping me organize all this data. I stop his clock and now he has more time to look for a job.
Is there any paperwork I need to do as Kadima Careers?
An offer letter.
But an offer letter is easy.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
So I just need to put something on Kadima Careers letterhead and say, hey, Daniel, I'd love to hire you as an intern 20 hours a week. Doing something aligned with your, like you're a data scientist, so I need some data done.
Like you literally walk through like what they're doing, like kind of like the task of a job description. And you put that in the offer. Right. Like, hey, Alan, welcome. Super excited for the 6-month internship. This is the task that you'll be doing. Kind of like, you know, like an offer, like a real job offer.
There's no extra paperwork I need to do as an employer. No.
They then, because they're on their OPT, they then take it to their international students office at their school. Their school has like an officer. They then submit the paperwork to immigration and that stops their clock. And so the way I tell them is, as soon as we get you a job, you give me a 2-week off, 2 weeks off that you're quitting and I'm okay with it, right? No harm, no foul, right?
So I can hire interns and they can do work that furthers their study and it actually helps their career. I wouldn't just like have them do nothing. But if I needed like help with growth marketing, I can find someone who's a marketing major and have them do some growth marketing. It benefits them and I don't even have to pay them. Correct. Or am I allowed to pay them?
You're allowed. Yeah, you're allowed. You're allowed to pay them. Yeah, you're allowed to pay them, but you're also allowed to make it a free internship. I work with a lot of international students. I can't give everyone an internship. Everyone that I work with in that scenario don't, because this happens very often. We actually have a sheet. And if you're listening to this and you want to know the sheet on how to stop it, just message me on LinkedIn and I'll send it to you. But there's a couple of ways to stop it. And I always say the easiest way to do this is most of the international students worked on campus because they could only work on campus for the first 2 semesters. So they have a relationship with a professor or someone. And so if the easiest way before they go in and do an internship with you, I would even say go back to your university, talk to the professor and say, hey, professor, as you know, I'm an international student. Can I do some research for you? Or work for you for free or help you with your research. And most professors are doing research at a really good university. Most of their time is not on research. And they'll get a letterhead from their school. And it's very easy. Very, very easy. Second option can be, I always say, go do a nonprofit. Go do a project for a nonprofit. You're helping the nonprofit. And then you're helping build your skill sets. And then you stop your clock. Third option, I'll help you. If the choices are you go home or I give you an internship, it's a very easy decision, right? We'll find you a project. But that to me is the third option. And then there's another option actually that's the route less taken is a little bit more complex. I'm not as familiar on it. I can only tell you kind of how it could work. We don't really ever get this far. Is you can actually start your own LLC and do a business as long as it's related to your major. And that also stops the clock for you. Is it like you essentially give yourself your own offer letter, right? I go to Florida, so sunbiz.org, create an LLC, right? Legit business in the United States. Anyone can start one. And then I give myself an offer letter and then I submit that. And that actually, that works, that's legally, and you can close the business once you get a job.
What about people that lost jobs? So like 18,000 people lost jobs at Amazon. I've heard lots of stories. Some of them were on visas. So they don't have a university to go back to. Mm-hmm. If I or you wanted to hire them as an intern, what would they need to do? Is that possible for someone that lost a job from one of those companies?
I'm going to say all this, like I am not an immigration lawyer. So everything that I'm sharing is my perspective from my experience for working. And so I want to make sure that everyone double checks what I'm saying before you make a life changing decision, right? Like, cause I am not an immigration. I've worked with immigration lawyers. We bring them into our program to talk to our students. And so this is the experience. So that free internship route only works in their first year of OPT. And I don't know if you remember when I said earlier that as long as you have a paying job, if you're a STEM student, you can apply for that OPT extension for two more years. Yeah. And that only is if you have a paying job that is market competitive, right? So like what I mean by that is me paying an intern $5 an hour as a data scientist is going to get rejected because a data scientist does not make less than $20,000 a year, right? Like, do you see what I'm saying? So I don't know about you, but I cannot just, I cannot afford paying someone $80,000, $90,000 a year to do a project. Like I'm not there yet. I don't know about you. So that's where it becomes really tricky, where I can't help them at that point. And they're like, well, Daniel, I'll work for free. But like it won't get approved. That extension won't get approved. And most of the people that you mentioned on the tech layoffs, they are in their OPT exemption. They've been in Amazon and Apple and Google for some time. They're not someone who's been there for 3 months. Maybe if some are, but that's a very, very small percentage.
You are clearly an expert in this. I know you're not a lawyer, but you definitely know the ins and outs, and you're helping so many people. So thank you for what you're doing. I just want to pivot quickly to one question that I have that's not immigration related. You have on your LinkedIn profile, and I know from talking to you in the past, you're really good from a strategic perspective of helping people land jobs. And you say, you know how to instantly beat over 85% of all other candidates at landing jobs. I don't know if you're okay sharing some of your secret sauce here. What are some of the tips for anybody, whether they're on a visa or not, of how to beat 85% of all other candidates and landing a great job?
Yeah. So the reason how I come up with that number is not like I just made it up and it sounds cool as a marketing strategy, right? If you look at like the data and the analytics of saying, okay, on average job, you get about 250 applications. That's an average. If you're going for the top tier companies, they probably get thousands of applications. Well, they do, right? So what I'm saying is, if you can get to the interview, because you know 250 people apply and only 5 to 10 people get to the interview, you're gonna instantly be 85% of people. And so what I'm saying is, most people are so focused on the applying and trying to just apply, they don't figure out or spend enough time on how to get to the interview. That whole theory is, how do we get you to the interview more often? How do we get you more? And to me, it comes down to visibility. And visibility becomes more important than ability to get to the interview, right? Because if you're just applicant 237 and you did nothing else but submit online, it's going to be very hard for you to get a fair shot at it. Because either the system, or even if a recruiter looked at your resume, they're only spending 7 seconds to a minute. Like, they're not spending a lot of time. So that's where focusing on the networking and getting visibility to your application becomes key. And this is especially true for international students who are very talented. And, you know, I would even say, like, technically speaking, probably even more talented than most of their American peers, because they're coming from their country with 3, 4, 5 years of experience already.
Right.
And so they have the technical skills, but they don't have the visibility. And so that's where I mean by that. It's focusing on the networking. So I have a rule. It's called the 10-5-1 rule. What I mean by that is, focus on 10 quality applications a week. But for every application, and before you submit the next one, I want you to find 5 people that work in the company you apply to. And not just any 5 people. I actually want you to find the people that have the same job that you just applied to. So you apply for a software developer in the Android team in Google on Mountain View. I want you to go to LinkedIn, put software engineer, search people, filter to Mountain View, filter to Google, and then go search it. There'll probably be like still hundreds of people. And then I want you to go through those hundreds of people, and I want you to find people who just got into that job in the last year. And the reason why I'm saying that is because those people are going to be most likely to reply to you than a senior manager. And I want you to just start there to build your confidence. And the reason I want you to do them is because most likely they know how it feels to be in your shoes, because they were not in your shoes not too long ago. And most likely you have way more in common with them than you do with the recruiter, because they also studied your major. And if you can find international students that do that, then you have that commonality. And the more you have in common, the better. And then the last tip, make sure they're active on LinkedIn before you send a message, right? So you go to activity and you see when was the last time they liked, posted, or anything like that. And then find at least 5 people. The more the better, but start with 5. And if you could do that and you send a personalized message, not copy and paste the message because you want efficiency, and make that message about them and something you found in common, like, hey, Alan, came across your profile as I was applying for software engineers level entry at Google. Notice that we're both from India and you just started there a year ago. We'll love to connect and learn your journey. Commonality. What you're going to find statistically, because we track all this data for our clients, is that you're going to get around a 60% reply rate. So out of those 5, you know, at least 3 to 4 of them will definitely reply. And out of those 3 and 4 replies, one of them should lead to a conversation that then can either lead to some sort of a referral or at least advice and visibility on who to talk to next. And so when you apply to 10 companies and you network with 5 people, that should lead to one conversation per company. And what we find is that about 10 to 20% of your applications turn into interviews. So if you're following this 10-5-1 process and you're doing this for 4 to 5 weeks, what you're finding in a matter of like 4 or 5 weeks, you're having 1 to 2 interviews with really great companies. And then in less than 12 weeks, you start getting offers. And so that's kind of like our process in a nutshell.
And it's all about the relationships. Mm-hmm. And we teach that here at Kadima Careers as well. We have the 40, 30, 20, 10, 5, because I like to complicate things with more numbers. But I'm like 40 target companies, 30 reach outs per week, 20 star stories, so that when you're ready to interview, you have those behavioral based stories at your disposal. The 10 applications, which we're spot on, the 5 informational interviews that I talk about, and to all those conversations that you have. And I tell people not to ask for referrals, but rather earn referrals. Mm-hmm. Because when you ask for referrals, everybody will say yes to your face, and very few will actually follow up on that. But yeah, and that's why I like you. I like you anyway. We could have disagreed on things. And I do disagree on your tagline on LinkedIn that it says, I just personally disagree that dream jobs, I don't think they exist. So you're like, learn how to land your dream job. I personally have had 29 jobs at 21 companies. None of them have been a dream for me. So maybe I'm just having lots of sleepless nights. I've had good jobs.
Can we talk about that for a second though?
Yeah,
because I actually agree with you. But here's the funny part, right? It doesn't matter what me and you think. It's about what the job candidate thinks. And so if I can talk their language to then help them, yep, I'd rather do that, right?
Yep.
And so I'll give you another really quick example. Resumes are important, but they're not as important as what everyone makes it seem like. And mm-hmm. So when I talk to somebody who's looking for help in that discovery call, I emphasize that we're going to help you with your resume, even though I know the resume help might be like 5% of what we do for them. But because I need to help them understand that we're going to help them with what they think to perceive the problem is or perceive the solution to be, so that once they're in the program, I can then guide them to everything else that really matters, which is the relationships and all of that. So without that being said, I actually agree with you in the sense, but I know that because it's there, I'm going to be able to impact more people. So
that is some sick advice. And I agree wholeheartedly. And I do find that applicants and people spend way too much on resumes because it's not going to make or break the search. The relationships will. And Daniel, we can go on and on. And next time I'm in Orlando, we'll grab a beer or something, or cerveza or what have you. But the last two questions I want to ask you is, what is, besides the fact that people focus too much on their resumes, leave the Sick Career audience here with one last piece of parting advice. What is the sickest career advice that you would have for my audience?
Besides the resume, I would actually say this. Every interview comes down to one question. So you might go to 3 rounds of interviews. And every round you might get asked 10 questions. So you may get asked a total of 30 questions. But it always comes down to one question. Why are you the best investment for a job? How do you solve my problem, right? And when you think about that in that way, there's 2 things that you look at when you're looking at an investment. What's the risk versus a reward? And so what I want you to do is when you're walking into the interview, think about that. What is the risk and the reward that the hiring manager might see in me? So if you're super overqualified for the role, you're not so much focused on saying how I can do the job, but you're focused on how I'm going to be here long term. Because the hiring manager is thinking, hey, this person's super qualified. I know they can do it, but they're just using me as a stepping stone. They're going to leave in 6 months. So your interview should be focused on why you're not leaving. If you're underqualified, the manager's not worried about you leaving. The manager's worrying about, can this person do the job? So if you look at the job description and you like are below that 50% qualification based on the bullet points, you're focused on, hey, what I lack in skills, I make up with work ethic. Alan, I'm going to be the first one in, first one out. So I want you guys to think everything that you learn about interviewing, the STAR method, having STAR, all that is good. The top level strategy is making sure that you're answering that question.
You got to know your audience, and the hiring manager is the decision maker. So you need to market yourself to them, which is really sick advice. So you deliver there. Last question I got for you, Daniel, and I know you hinted at this before, but let's just share again. where can people find you and your wisdom? Where's the best way that they can reach out to you, and how can you support them?
Simply LinkedIn. If you have any questions about the international student, like immigration status or anything like that, just if you search Daniel Botero, B-O-T-E-R-O on LinkedIn, connect with me and send me a message. Say where you found me, and I will reply. And anybody that does, if you want a free LinkedIn review, I would be more than happy to give you. But Alan, again, I just, before you kind of wrap it up, I want to thank you for creating this space and having me in it.
Well, thank you, Daniel. Really appreciated the conversation. We will probably have other conversations, whether it's on the Sick Career Podcast in Orlando. If you're ever in New York, let me know. And thanks so much for joining us on the Sick Career Podcast, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
That wraps up another remarkable episode of the Sick Career Podcast with Alan Stein. Check out past episodes and other resources on the website. That's sickpodcast.com, and it's S-Y-C-K. Alan, tell the audience about the newsletter they can sign up for.
The newsletter rocks. Check out the accelerator, XLR8R. You will get great tips about your career. You'll get honest insights. You'll get the occasional pet picture. And you will learn how to take proactive control and take charge of your career.
Very good. Very good. That's sickpodcast.com, S-Y-C-K. For your host, Alan Stein, I'm Russ Reba. And we hope you've enjoyed today's episode. You are going to love the next one.